From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Whatever happens in the next 24 hours or so, 2019 has been a banner year for the stock market. The NASDAQ composite is up some 36%, the Dow up nearly 23%, and the S&P 500 up 29%, close to having its best annual gain in 22 years. Joining us now is Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton in Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
So whether or not the stock market actually hits that record this year, it's been a very good year for stocks. What do you attribute that to?
Well, the biggest factor to attribute it to is the Federal Reserve. They basically did a 180 and took back what they gave us in terms of rate hikes in 2018. They did rate cuts. And as a result, that helped to spur financial market conditions. We also saw the Federal Reserve have to expand its balance sheet. And it says this is not what it calls quantitative easing because it's dealing with problems in the overnight repurchase market. But at the end of the day, if it, you know, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And that has also helped financial markets at this stage of the game. What we worry about is how much it's helped financial markets, because actually profit margins have been narrowing since 2014. And profits have not been remarkably great, even though the markets have been remarkably great. It's also important to remember that the broader stock indices do not reflect profits in the overall economy. They now reflect a sort of distilled version of the largest, most profitable companies out there. So they may be outperforming the overall economy by a fairly large margin as well.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit, because President Trump has been holding rallies saying that this is the best economy ever. Is there evidence that a lot of Americans are not feeling this good economy that he talks about?
It's a great economy. That's important. We are at the lowest unemployment rate in over 50 years. That said, I think you have to go back and look at how did we get here? We got there by a lower participation rate. We're now back with the prime age, that's 25 to 54 year olds, participating in the labor force about the same pace they did before the financial crisis, but nowhere near the highs we saw in the 1990s boom. So even though we now have the longest expansion on record, what we've had in stamina is trying to make up for the fact we've not had as much momentum as we like. And even the growth in the economy has underperformed what the administration had hoped we'd see on the tails of tax cuts and stimulus. So we're still chugging along, and that stamina is really important, because the longer the marathon of this expansion goes, the more people who can enter the race from the sidelines. That said, you know, we're finally recouping some of what was lost in wages at the low end of the wage spectrum, but we have yet to see the trickle up into middle-income households. It is a good economy. It is getting better, but you actually see it in the consumer sentiment and confidence figures as well, as we've yet to hit the euphoria of the 1990s, even though we're at lower measures of unemployment than we were back then. And that's because the dirt is in the details. There's some really great things about this economy, and there's some things that aren't so great, that income inequalities and wealth inequalities in particular continue to widen.
Well, and if a lot of the expansion right now is based on what the Fed is doing, what do you expect the Fed to do in the next year? Do you expect them to raise interest rates again?
You know, this is the million-dollar question, or we should say trillion-dollar question right now for the year ahead, because that's the way these numbers are going. I actually expect that the Fed will have to eat a little more humble pie and take back one more interest rate cut in 2020 and actually cut rates. I think they'd like to be on the sidelines the whole year. From the Fed's perspective, one of the things Jay Powell, the chairman of the Fed, has made a goal is that he wants to see some heat in the economy. What he means by that is heat in wages, where middle-income households can feel the gains of the economy as well.
Okay, one more thing I want to ask you about. A lot of people predicted that there would be a recession in 2019. Obviously, that didn't happen. What are you thinking about 2020? And is it possible that whatever triggers the next recession in this country, whenever that comes, is going to be a surprise? It's going to be something that not everybody was thinking about.
The problem is it's almost always a surprise.
Right.
So the chances are fairly high that it'll be a surprise. My concerns were always for 2020. And we have done a 180 on many of the factors that would have tipped us into recession. You know, the Federal Reserve has eased instead of tightened rates further. We've actually seen some calm in trade disputes, although we have yet to see, as the ongoing trade negotiations with China and the U.S. continue, if we can keep the pause button hit. But there's still a whole spectrum of things That is in the geopolitical situation and what's going on in Europe. We still have a Brexit to go through. All of those things are still on the horizon. And for the moment, it feels okay. And confidence has certainly shifted. The biggest shift from a year ago is sentiment. But remember, a year ago, when sentiment was so fearful, it almost took us into a recession.
That is Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton. Diane, thanks as always, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Let's get some perspective now on those two attacks on places of worship over the weekend. A shooter killing two worshipers at a church service yesterday in the Native American named White Settlement, Texas, before he was killed by an armed church security team. And in Muncie, New York, outside Manhattan, a machete-wielding man stormed into a rabbi's home Saturday night during a Hanukkah celebration, injuring five. Today, he was charged with federal hate crimes. Juliette Kynam is the former Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security in the Obama administration. So, Juliette, two attacks. Are you hearing police bracing for more?
Yes, I think that there's always a concern around the holidays, in particular, a sense of isolation. People aren't in schedules. And also just, I think, fears of copycat, that what you will see is increased security presence at places of worship, in particular, synagogues at this stage, because the attacks on synagogues or Orthodox Jews who are simply walking down streets or at markets is an epidemic this last week. I think we're monitoring sort of 12 incidences in New York alone in the last week. So this is something that's being monitored. It's obviously something that places of worship will take control of, whether they have increased security presence and begin to do something that's unfortunate for places of worship, which has become more securitized and less open.
Well, of course, we hear the ones that make the headlines, the attack on the deli in New Jersey, or the horrific attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh. But you're saying there are far more attacks than people know.
Right. I mean, some of them are just beating up someone. This happened in New York, in Manhattan, an Orthodox Jew. And so that is something that's being monitored by organizations like ADL. But if you just take a step back at the totality of the numbers that we're seeing, not just anti-Semitism, but just the totality, I'm just reflecting what the FBI is monitoring, which is a 20% increase in hate crimes, in particular against Hispanics and Mexican immigrants, that you're seeing nationally. These numbers are now at a stage where white supremacy has by far overtaken Islamic terrorism as the greatest domestic terrorism threat that we're seeing in this country today.
Well, police say that the church shooter in Texas this past weekend was relatively transient. He had an arrest record. That armed security guard group within the church had their eye on him, noticed him. He was acting oddly, shot him almost immediately. The family of the Hanukkah stabber said he's mentally ill. But we refer to some of these other cases, the kosher supermarket attack in New Jersey.
Exactly.
Those attackers may have had links to a group known as the Black Hebrew Israelites. That's an anti-Semitic, anti-police group. They also killed a policeman.
Right.
So what is the sense? Are these lone wolf attacks that are on the rise or groups?
It's groups and attacks against the Jewish community, unfortunately, can be the focus of the right and the left. But then just taking the big view, I do not believe there are lone wolves anymore. I look at these numbers. I'm an expert in counterterrorism. We are seeing a phenomenon known as what's called stochastic terrorism. It's a type of terrorism that we're seeing in the United States now. And it has three key attributes. The first is obviously a perpetrator who feels isolated or what we call displaced by the other. They feel like the immigrant from Mexico is displacing their way of being. The second, they have a sense of community, right? So they're both isolated, but they have a sense of community online. And this is why people like me and others are very critical of Facebook and other social media platforms that aren't regulating this kind of hate. They find comfort and power in the group. So they're not lone wolves by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But I think, Robin, the third most important is they have a sense of acceptance in the public space. This is what is known as stochastic terrorism. It is the use of language of division by leaders, whether it's Donald Trump or others, that has a greater likelihood that there will be violence in response, but it is unpredictable what that violence will be. In other words, what does a person do in response to language like that? And it's a phenomenon a lot of us have been talking about, that the public space is on fire. And what we need from leadership is to lower the fire, right? That is how you get people to feel isolated, to not take up arms, to not take up violence. And so while I don't think, you know, one thing that the president says leads to, you know, a hate crime, I do think that we miss the big picture if we don't see that through line between our public discourse at the very top and what is happening by the numbers in communities across America today.
Well, we should know President Trump called the attack in the rabbi's home horrific and anti-Semitism an evil scourge. Security expert Juliette Kayyem, with a new word for many, stochastic terrorism. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, alone, the word stochastic means random, but as Juliette said, when there's hate rhetoric from a leader or an online community that may not call for violence but make listeners feel threatened, it can motivate seemingly random acts of terror. Fascinating.
You have just 2 weeks left to see the Broadway hit Freestyle Love Supreme, the show that makes the audience the star. It's the brainchild of the creative minds behind In the Heights and Hamilton, including Lin-Manuel Miranda and Thomas Kail. In October, I spoke with three of the cast members, Utkarsh Ambudkar, who goes by UTK the INC, Chris Sullivan, who goes by Shockwave, and Anthony Veniziale, or Two Touch. And I asked Anthony, who was also a founder, how the idea came about.
It was just a terrible idea that spun into an awful 15 years. We were working on In the Heights at the Drama Bookshop, and we had all gone to Wesleyan together. Lin was there sort of workshopping and working under Tommy's guidance, and I was sort of the interlocutor who would jump in and be like, Lin, let's freestyle rap. And I just convinced Lin that it was a good idea to do this in front of people. Because, like, we did it at every cast party. We did it in between breaks and stuff. And then finally I convinced him, and we had a show on August 16th of 2003, which is the day after the Eastern Seaboard blackout on August 15th of 2003.
Right. Yes, a very famous moment in New York City history. Was it always, though, in those early days, successful enough that you thought this is a good idea? Because I can imagine it going wrong if you're just not all in sync with each other about how to make words people say into something that's compelling and entertaining.
I think the short answer is yes. The long answer is no, yes, sometimes. I mean, when you do this thing, especially when you're first starting out, like, it's terrifying and you're terrible at it. And I'm still terrible at it. There are some shows that I have where I'll try to set up a rhyme and I fail at it. But that's, I think, a part of our show. We allow the audience to see the rough edges and some of the mistakes. And so more importantly for me was that the audience was with us. And when we made those mistakes, it kind of even got us more empathy and more cred with the audience that it was happening in the moment. So once that happened, it's one of those things you're like, oh, I need to do this all the time. It's my favorite thing. Oh, God, I can't wait to do it again.
Okay, well, I think we've gone on too long without giving listeners an idea of what we're talking about here.
Sure.
So what you do in the show involves audience members giving you words and you all freestyle off of those words. I guess since I'm the audience now, you tell me what you want and you can do what you do.
Great. Why don't you give us like a word at a time and we'll just ask you for the next word and we'll have UTK kick it off and Shock will do a beat and then he'll maybe trade with me at some point and I'll give it a shot to fail miserably as well.
Okay. And I'm going to look at our show and the words that are in our show in the news right now. So Brexit.
Okay. Here we go. Jeremy, let me step in. Exit. Like the UK did with Brexit. I'll break it apart, put it together. That's right, I spit these flows forever. Give me another word.
Israel.
Baruch Atah Adonai. When I spit so fly, I do it till I'm full. I do it for Israel, do it for Jerusalem without a pen. And I spit a Broadway show with all of my friends. One more word.
Election.
Okay, do it for your protection. No politics, don't want to talk elections. Just want to say you should get out and vote. Whatever you do is fine for me. And I just hope you express your voice. Take a choice, because it's yours, your power. That's right, don't be a coward. Put on your cowl, put on your cape. Because if you vote when you can, it would be great. Now I'm going to pass it off to Anthony. And you could give him a word and he can show you what he does.
Oh my God, that was so good.
Apples.
Okay, well, thanks for giving me that that much lower stage of entry. You see, I'm just like Scrapple in the Midwest of Pennsylvania. No apples to be in my brain. I'm not no Johnna Gold. I'm just feeling like I was a cameo. Or maybe you could Macintosh on my flow. Oh. In other words?
Whistleblower.
All right. Could we even get any lower? I mean, this country needs more whistleblowers. I'm not looking at the White House. I'm just looking for how I can get out.
So, yeah.
That's kind of what we do.
Wow.
I'm going to be honest, Jeremy. You're yes. giving of the words Bad next words. Time. We should just go a little faster. that's for you. Next rehearsal, we're going to work on that.
I'm just a lowly audience member. I don't know how this is.
The audience member makes up most of our show, so you're an exalted audience member.
Well, yeah. And I have to say, when I went, one of the words was empathy. And then it becomes a whole song that involves the word empathy. And I thought to myself, and of course I'm sitting there like trying to figure out how the magic trick works. And I'm like, I wonder if it has to be a 3-syllable word. Is there anything about the number of syllables that goes into what you do?
That's a great question, a very technical question from an intelligent and exalted audience member who needs to work on his word giving, but otherwise is crushing. No, we don't hold a syllable structure or anything. Certainly the more syllables, it can be fun. We all know that there are certain rhymes, ATE words, invigorate, instigate, imitate, that have more rhymes that go with them. But the point is to pick a word and then speak the truth.
You're also pulling together pieces of everything that the audience has said to you throughout the show that you might not even use directly, but you'll remember it and bring it back later, which brings an even bigger reaction from the audience when you do that. You got to have your memory working all cylinders running throughout that entire show.
Yeah, basically like our job and the way that we support it and what makes the show such a fun event for the audience and for us is that it's a real exercise in hyper-listening. When Anthony or Shockwave or Lynn or whoever's on stage, it's my sort of privilege and gift to be able to listen to them and give them all of my energy. And we've sort of just learned to retain the things that the audience likes along the way so that we can give them the joy of bringing it back up.
Now, one of the things that you do at this show, which I've never seen before, although, frankly, in this modern age where everybody's using their cell phones all the time, it seems like it's a pretty good idea that we should do this, which is that you take every – not you, but the people that, as you walk into the theater, they take everybody's phone and put it in a little pouch that immediately locks and can't be unlocked until the show is over. What's that about?
Well, there's also an escape clause, which is if you have an emergency and you need to get it open, you can leave the theater at any time. And it's just this little magnetic thing that opens it, just like if you were shopping at the Gap and you left with that little tag on. But the reason why we did that for our show was a couple of big points for us. First, it helps the audience to be really connected as a community. And what we're doing up there on stage, yes, we deeply listen to you, the audience. And then what we're asking from you is that you deeply listen to us. The hope here is that we're all in the moment together witnessing these connections and the neural networking that's taking place in our brains that's then creating a mesh network out there in the audience as well. So that's one. Two, we're also saying crazy things. We are doing stuff as characters of the audience and made up worlds. And if someone were to film that and then take it out of context, I mean, any night you could probably get a recording of me pretending to be Trump saying, I want the world to end and this is our society now. I'm going to rule forever. And like if you take that out of context, yeah, I mean, the alt-right would really love to smear me with that, I'm sure. So what we're saying to the audience is, hey, we're going to be vulnerable as well. So we don't want that then leaving this community afterward in a way that would potentially damage anyone.
I wonder if other Broadway shows are going to pick up this idea because it is annoying when somebody pulls their phone out in the middle of the show.
Yeah, that glowing white light. Exactly. Yeah, it's funny for those of us who remember before cell phones.
What?
It's almost a no-brainer. We're on stage and it just feels – it harkens back to more innocent times.
The late 90s.
Thank you, Morgan Freeman.
Chris Sullivan, let me ask you, because you run the Freestyle Love Supreme Academy, which is a school for people who want to learn how to do what you do. Is it very difficult to teach it?
No, absolutely not. It's not difficult to be in it either. Myself and Anthony and Andrew Bancroft, a.k.a. Jelly Donut, also a member of Freestyle Love Supreme, we sort of a combination of responding to the demand of people asking, how do we do this? And aside from saying 15 years of practice, there are also other building bones to learning this process.
Anissa Folds, who is a member of Freestyle Love Supreme, she goes by Young Niece, went through the Freestyle Love Supreme Academy with these guys and is now with us every single night on Broadway, which is to say that if you take the Freestyle Love Supreme Academy class,
that's not,
you'll end up on Broadway. It's a guarantee. It's in the bylaws. If you do the class, you go on Broadway. Am I right, guys?
We can edit this, right?
Okay, before we let you guys go, I want to just have you do something which we'll probably save forever, which is, can you do a here and now freestyle?
Are we here? Are we now? Yeah, we came to put it down with the sound. Are we here? Are we now?
Yeah, we came together, put it down, down with the sound. Are we here, here, here? Are we now, now, now? Yeah, we came to put it down with the sound. Yeah, are we here? Are we now? I'm gonna speak quiet then loud. That's right, I'm proud of the team we have made. That's right, I like the sound and it plays on the radio like every day. Here we are, spitting it on NPR.
Yeah, NPR, can you just be like Albert Camus and maybe get a little existential? Cause are you here or are you now? I don't know, what is it detrimental? Come on, UTK, it's elemental.
Oh yeah, existential, damn. I'm here and now like Van Damme. In time cop, that's right, I stop. I may have dropped that bar just a little bit.
Is it here? Is it now? How are we gonna put it down with the sound?
Is it here?
Is it now?
Is it now?
How are we gonna put it down
with the sound?
Amazing, guys. Thank you so much. That is Anthony Veneziale, Chris Sullivan, and Utkarsh Ambudkar. Thank you so much to all of you, and good luck with Freestyle Love Supreme on Broadway.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy. And remember, take the class. You'll end up on Broadway.
No, wait, I'll be there.
Not the message.
Our conversation from October. The show closes January 12th.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news. Impeachment and the upcoming trial have been sucking all the air out of Washington, but Congress did manage to pass a new $1.4 trillion spending bill, and inside it are significant changes for retirement savers. Rolled into the new spending bill is something called the SECURE Act, which stands for Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement, and tries to address the fact that, according to the Federal Reserve, a quarter of Americans have no retirement savings at all. For years, Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money, has been telling us people haven't saved enough for retirement. She joins us now. And Jill, what does this overhaul, you know, it's being called the biggest update to retirement in a decade, what does it do?
So many things. So, like, from the big picture, what this is trying to do is try to get more people to contribute to retirement. And a lot of the rules that are in place right now are changing pretty dramatically. So let's start with the requirement that says you have to take money out of your retirement plan after you turn age 70 and a half. Mm-hmm. That is going to turn into a 72. So if you are turning 70 and a half after December 31st, 2019, you will not have to do it at 70 and a half. You have to do it at age 72.
Okay, I want to hold you up there. What does this mean if you're approaching 70 and a half? Can you now automatically go to 72?
Well, here's the thing. If you don't take the money out that you're supposed to take out, there is a whopping 50% penalty. So if you were supposed to take $3,000 out at the end of the calendar year after you've turned 70 and a half, and you don't take it, that would have meant a $1,500 penalty. Mm. Now, the penalty still exists. It's just that it's moving to age 72. And what's important is that you, if you're already 70 and a half before December 31st, the old rule's in place. If you turn 70 and a half after the 31st, then you get to wait until you're 72.
And the reason to wait is?
Well, the reason to wait is always to delay your tax hit, right? Because when that money comes out, you have to pay whatever your tax bracket is at the time on that money. Again, that money's never been taxed. So the idea that you are somehow feel ripped off, because a lot of people always say to me like, oh, why does this have to happen? You haven't paid tax on it yet. So it's time to pay taxes. The one thing that's really important about the required minimum distribution that people don't realize is when you do delay it, it can impact lots of different things. You might have more income than you want to have later in life. That can affect the cost of your Medicare. It could also impact the tax rate on which you pay your Social Security benefits.
Yeah. What else does it do?
You know, for people who actually have retirement plans right now, specifically a 401k, there are going to be some changes in the way the balances are actually shown to you. So let's just pretend that you're, you know, 40 years old and it shows $50,000 that you've saved in your 401k. The new rule will require the plan provider to translate that into future income. And here's what I mean. $50,000 looks like a big chunk of money. You feel happy about it. But when the provider then says to you, that actually means $200 a month when you retire, doesn't look as good. Mm-hmm. So what the rule's trying to do is try to give you a better reflection of how the money you have in an account can translate into monthly retirement income.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News, host of Jill on Money. We'll post her writing on the new Secure Act at hearnow.org. Jill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a weekend of fear for those involved in two separate attacks on places of worship. Saturday, Hasidic Jews celebrating Hanukkah at a rabbi's home in New York. Yesterday, Christians at a church in Texas. But of course, this is also a season of faith, and our next guest recently decided to dig deeper into hers. Sarah Hurwitz was Michelle Obama's speechwriter, before that President Obama's. Like many Jewish Americans, she considered herself secular, leaving the whole religious part behind after her Hebrew school days. So she says she was as surprised as anyone that her new book, Here All Along, chronicles her embrace of Judaism as an adult. She says her deep dive into centuries of Jewish texts, interpretations, and debates gave her a new moral compass and a political one demanding activism, and she says it can be applied to all faiths. Sarah Hurwitz, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
And we should say you pointed that as one of the things that you and many families did. You know, there might be two or three days a year where you were really, really Jewish.
Right. And Hanukkah was definitely one of them.
Right. But this isn't just a Jewish thing. I think there are many people who recognize that, you know, being of the faith maybe a couple times a year, but feeling pulled away by modernity. Talk about how you suddenly fell back into the faith. It was kind of an accident.
It was an accident. You know, at the age of 36, I broke up with a guy I was dating. Mm-hmm. I was bored and lonely and anxious. I happened to hear about an Intro to Judaism course, and I signed up completely on a whim. But what I found in that class blew me away. You know, I always think, like, oh, I'm a good person. I don't lie, cheat, or steal. I follow American law. That's a low bar. Right? That's really designed to make sure I don't steal your property or assault you or infringe on your rights. But Jewish law is designed to make sure that I'm honest, I'm generous, I'm kind, I'm loving, and it sets a very high bar. Do I gossip? Do I shame people? Am I unkind? It really made me thoughtful about my speech.
Do you wake up? What is the prayer? I loved it. Grateful I am?
Yes. It's Moda Ani, which in Hebrew means thankful my. You literally start out the minute you wake up expressing gratitude for the blessing that is your life.
So you started studying all the major Jewish philosophers. Maimonides gave you some political lessons, too, such as listen to the truth from whoever says it.
Yes.
So did you start to see, wait a minute, there's a line here that maybe I didn't even recognize while having one of the headiest positions in politics, which is top speechwriter for the Obamas. Did you start to see, wait a minute, maybe this was percolating all along.
It didn't change what I was doing in politics, but it helped me recognize and better understand what I was doing. So I think of the core Jewish, what I think is the core animating Jewish idea that we're all created in the image of the divine, which you don't have to believe in any kind of God to understand the value of that, which is we're all infinitely worthy, all totally equal to each other, and each fundamentally unique.
This is reminding me, this idea that we are all created equally, about some of the things you observed Michelle Obama say. For instance, there was that high school commencement speech. This was a school attended primarily by Native American students in Santa Fe, New Mexico. They never thought Michelle Obama would come. What did she say to them?
She told them, first of all, how proud she was of them. And she talked about her family story, the many generations of her family, that her great-great-grandfather was a slave, to her parents dealing with segregation, to herself and then her children.
And told them, of course you should ask me to come. And you said you saw in that speech not only how the U.S. has changed, how the Constitution has been amended and reamended, but also parallels to the Torah. How so?
We do not live by an original version of the Constitution, thank God. Mm. I mean, that literally allowed slavery. Fortunately, our Constitution is a living document. We're allowed to amend it. Thankfully, we amended it to get rid of slavery. We amended it to allow women to vote. The Torah, it's 2,500 years old. When it says an eye for an eye, Jews reimagined that 2,000 years ago. Ancient rabbis 2,000 years ago said, no. That means if you put out someone's eye, you have to monetarily compensate them. So just as the Constitution is to all of the Supreme Court cases and amendments, the Torah is to all these thousands of years of commentary and interpretation.
And many would say the Bible is as well.
Yes.
I have to ask you about writing words for Michelle Obama. When she gave speeches, for instance, at the Democratic Convention, or when she said, when they go low, we go high. Were those a speechwriter's words?
When they go low, we go high were 100% her words. She came up with that line. I just typed it into the speech. You know, Michelle Obama is someone who knows who she is, and she always knows what she wants to say. So as her speechwriter, you don't script someone like that. You channel them.
So when she says, I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves and I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
That was something, you know, I'm sure it was something that we sort of came up with together or sort of based on something she had said. You know, it really is a partnership, right? They're dictating, you're channeling, going back and forth, sharing edits, but it really kind of originates with her.
Well, and going back to when they go low, we go high, you say that's one of the critical tenets of your new understanding of Judaism.
I think it is. You know, I do think the core animating idea of Judaism is that we're all created in the divine image. When other people have an instinct to degrade, to dehumanize, to be cruel, we don't stoop down to their level.
Okay, so for someone listening who might be thinking, you know, you seem like a pretty good person. Why did you need this?
Well, the problem is we all think we're good people, right? But I realize in studying Judaism, I'm not really a great person. The ethical standard that Judaism dictates is much higher than just like, you do you, but don't hurt others and be nice when you can, right? It's, you know, everyone knows you give money to charity, but how much and how do you do it? Do you do it in a way that preserves their dignity? Do you do it anonymously? You know, Judaism really gets down to the weeds and says, okay, actually this much, and you do it this way. And there's a lot of debates and conversations about how and how much and what's the best way. And you realize, whoa, it's a higher standard.
Well, you also say the Torah strikes me as an unavoidably political document, a passionate protest against the old hierarchies and abuse of power. That's the kind of thing that strikes fear in people's hearts when people start saying that the Bible is giving them political direction.
And I agree with them, right? If you're saying the Bible dictates that I have to vote Democrat or I have to support this candidate or that, that's very dangerous. But what I do believe is that if you look at the Torah, I don't know how you can avoid the fact that it's a political document. The Torah is obsessed with poverty, income inequality, how we treat the strangers among us. The stranger was the immigrant. It's the refugee. I think that you can actually make arguments on many sides of the immigration, the debate, the healthcare debate, citing Jewish texts. However, to say that Judaism shouldn't be political is to fundamentally not have read the Torah.
It's not about which opinion is right. It's about have the debate and
exactly. We
examine.
Can't avoid these issues. These are inherent in our core sacred text.
Well, and you also quote a Christian writer who you say gave you another religion lesson, which is that it's not cool to remake God in your own image. She said, you can safely assume you've created God in your image. when it turns out God hates all the same people you do.
Exactly. That is Anne Lamott. And look, this is the problem that I have with this sort of spirituality and theology that many of us think we see in ancient religions. Growing up, I thought the Jewish God was a man in the sky who controlled everything and rewarded us when we were good and punished us when we were bad. Daily life shows me otherwise every single hour of every day, and I find it really problematic. However, that's not what Judaism says. Judaism has all kinds of different conceptions of the divine. There's one conception, the mystical conception, that says we're all God. God is the animating energy of the universe.
Namaste. The divine in me meets the divine in you.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And this is actually, it's funny you say this. I look at a lot of modern day spirituality, and you know, when it's unanchored in any, you know, greater tradition, it does become very much like, well, this affirms me and this makes me feel this. I call out to the universe. And it's like, that's great. But does the universe ever call back and demand that you live by a high ethical standard and care for others?
Can you just say, is there, you know, something that really, really surprised you? You've given us some overarching thoughts, but is there something that really surprised you about the faith you grew up with?
I was surprised by just how little dogma there is, right? If you say, what does Judaism say about X? It's pretty rare that you'll get a Judaism says this. I also just think the complexity of Jewish spirituality. It's not man in the sky or atheism. There's a lot of very sophisticated God concepts. I've had friends of all religious backgrounds, adamant atheists, who've read my book and said, okay, some of these God concepts are not crazy.
By the way, was one of those friends that read the book and loved it, did they happen to be Michelle Obama? And just between us, like, what did she say?
I mean, just between us, right? Just, you know, it's funny. I gave them copies of the book, and Mrs. Obama sent the most beautiful tweet. Okay. I adore her.
Well, and by the way, you had to be one of the few people who walked on Barack Obama. You're one of the only people who left that part of the White House because you wanted to work with Michelle Obama.
Yes, I was with him for a year and a half, 2 years. Wonderful.
You just didn't have the thing. You know?
You know, it's just funny. I just felt more at home in her voice.
Did you tell him something like, Mr. President, don't worry, you're going to get this speech-making thing down. You will get
He had it. I was not worried about him. He'd be just fine with no speechwriters at all, and so would she.
Sarah Hurwitz, her new book, Inviting People to Reexamine Judaism or Any Faith, is Here All Along, Finding Meaning, Spirituality, and a Deeper Connection to Life in Judaism After Finally Choosing to Look There. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We now know of one thing that'll be bigger in 2020. Those huge SUVs, like the 2021 Chevy Tahoe, which will be 6.7 inches longer than the 2020 version. Joining us now is Nathan Bomey, a business trends reporter for USA Today. Hi, Nathan.
How are you?
I'm doing well. So how much of a difference does 6.7 inches make in the scheme of these giant SUVs?
You know, it doesn't sound like a lot, but it really is. A few inches in the auto industry makes a huge visual difference. In fact, really, when the automakers even add 1 or 2 inches to a vehicle, you can really tell. And so when you see General Motors adding half a foot to the Chevy Tahoe, which was already a really hulking vehicle, that's going to make a significant visual difference. But it's really a trend that we're seeing across the industry.
Well, tell us more. I mean, what other automakers are making these big SUVs even bigger?
You know, I think in some ways, GM is actually responding to the market here because just a couple years ago, Ford made the Expedition, which is a Tahoe competitor, a few inches bigger. And, you know, it's not just the traditional big three automakers, too. You look at Toyota, which, of course, broke into the United States with small cars. They're making their SUVs bigger, too. The 2020 Toyota Highlander SUV is actually bigger than the 1999 Chevrolet Tahoe, which shows you how this size creep happens over time.
And why are they doing this?
You know, I think this is a response to what Americans want. When you look at the focus groups and the surveys and basically anecdotal information from when people visit the dealerships, they say they want more space. I guess this is sort of in some ways the quintessential American desire, you know, bigger is better. And I think one reason is gas prices haven't really been a problem for years now. It's not necessarily the fact that they're lower than $3 a gallon, which of course they are. It's the lack of volatility, the fact that Americans seem to think gas prices are really not at risk of spiking. Now, we know from a historical perspective that may not be the right bet, but for now, people seem to be confident that they're not going to get stuck with gas guzzlers.
Well, and these cars are not the gas guzzlers that they once were. I was surprised to see that many of these huge SUVs get 30 miles a gallon.
Yeah, and I think that's key here because, you know, when 2008 happened, of course, gas prices spiked and then the financial crisis hit. You know, there was a period there in which these types of SUVs were just caught in a terrible situation because no one wanted to be paying a lot for gas. And, you know, but the reality is that, yeah, the automakers have made significant fuel economy improvements in the last 10 to 15 years. And so, you know, you can definitely get a large SUV now that gets well into the 20s on the highway per gallon, that is, and even more than 30 miles per gallon. You know, if you have a small car from, say, the year 2000, you know, a big SUV actually might get better gas mileage than that 2000 model vehicle. That said, you know, the Tahoe is not really getting more than about 20 miles per gallon. So you're still going to pay a lot for gas if it ends up spiking at some point.
Do you expect that this trend, and we're going to, you know, at the end of this year, it looks like about half of the new vehicle sales in this country are expected to have been SUVs. Do you expect that trend is going to continue?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think that the industry analysts think that the SUV boom might finally be leveling off. We're at about 50% of vehicle sales now are SUVs. About 30% are cars, and then 20% are pickups. Hmm. So if 50% of SUVs, we may have hit a peak, but I don't think anyone sees it backing up at all. And, you know, what you see the automakers doing now is basically starting to create new niches for SUVs. So they're, you know, creating new types that really didn't even exist before. And it's also important to say that a lot of these that we kind of call SUVs are really cars. I mean, a lot of these small crossovers are essentially a car platform just with a little bit of a bigger body. And so, you know, some of the small crossovers get outstanding gas mileage. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but the big ones like the Tahoe and the Expedition and the Highlander, they're among the most popular models.
Nathan, do you think that all of the pressure from activists and others on climate change and trying to reduce carbon footprints is going to have an impact on the market for these giant SUVs?
You know, I don't think that much is going to reduce the demand for these types of vehicles short of federal regulation. You know, if fuel economy standards at some point, likely not under a Trump administration, of course, under a Democratic administration, perhaps, get stricter, that might end up rolling back some of the growth in vehicles. But I do not see, you know, climate activism or, you know, individuals believing that they need to adjust their lifestyles having a big impact on the market. There's simply not much evidence that people make car purchases based on their personal beliefs about mm-hmm. the environment. You know, I think if you take, for example, hybrids, you know, hybrid vehicles are really doing poorly, as poor as they've ever done at this point. The Toyota Prius is in very bad shape. In fact, Toyota just cut the Toyota Prius C, which was a one model, and the Prius V. The only one left is the regular Prius, and then there's also a plug-in. The good news for environmental activists and, you know, of course, anyone who believes, as of course it's correct, that climate change is a significant issue, is that electric cars are definitely coming. And so, you know, General Motors, Tesla, Ford, everybody is making an EV of some sort. And the only question is, when can they get those vehicles the same price as a conventional car? It's coming. It'll be soon, just not in the next year or two.
That is Nathan Bomey, a business trends reporter for USA Today. Nathan, thanks and Happy New Year.
All right. Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. Recently, some old friends got together and sang some favorite songs.
Newbie Arabella, early morning singing songs. Oh,
yeah. The 40th reunion of the cast of the movie Hair. Next time, Here and Now.